You're listening to the Mojo Matters podcast, episode 7. You're listening to the Mojo Matters podcast with me, your host, Jo Britton. Your mojo is your energy, your enthusiasm, and your motivation so that you've got the ability to get results for your personal and professional life without freaking out and burning out. Tune in for practical advice on how to find your mojo and keep it. Welcome back to another episode of Mojo Matters. If this is the first show you're tuning into, we discuss all things mojo, your mojo being your energy, enthusiasm and motivation, and your ability to navigate challenge and unpredictability in ways that are more productive and healthy for you. And I have amazing guests on the show who have been so willing to share their own personal stories, challenges they faced, and how they've overcome them with a view to helping others find some hope and inspiration. And that no matter how bad things may get, there's always hope and opportunity to turn things around so that you can live your life with more health, wealth, and happiness, however you choose to define those things, even when times are incredibly tough. And let's face it, they are for so many of us right now, as this episode is being recorded in November 2020, just as in the UK, we're a few days into lockdown too. It's also being recorded to coincide with Alcohol Awareness Week, which will be raising awareness between alcohol and mental health and the best ways to look after ourselves and those we love during this year of immense challenge and uncertainty. And I've been reading that around 1 in 4 people in the UK experience a mental health problem each year, and drinking too much all too often can increase our risk of that. But many of us are unaware of the link between alcohol and poor mental health, and it's often the first thing we turn to when we're feeling low, stressed, worried, or unable to cope. And I know that back in lockdown one, I remember just having a few more glasses of wine than I probably would normally have had. And certainly for me, wine o'clock time got a bit earlier each day as a way of trying to cope at the time. And maybe that's especially true for so many of us right now, as we're in the second lockdown in the UK. Secretly, I knew that drinking more was probably not a great idea. So I'm really pleased to be joined today by my wonderful guest, Becky Field, who, because of her own personal experiences with alcohol, she now works with others to help them. So I really wanted Becky on the show because she's got a really inspirational story to share. So Becky, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jo. Lovely to be here.
Great to have you. Now, when we had our prelim chat, you were telling me that back in 2005, you were using alcohol as a way of trying to change how you felt about yourself, and that to the outside world, you were this successful tutor, earning good money, had the lifestyle to match, but in reality, things were very different. So I wonder if we could pick up your story from here.
Yeah, absolutely. So the easiest way to describe how I was in 2005 was I was in camouflage. So I would drink with people who drank like me, only you know, and it was acceptable, I suppose, just to finish work and go over the pub and really, you know, have a few drinks to unwind. However, with me, I would carry on drinking. So I would finish the social drinking, as it were, and then I would just carry on and carry on and carry on. So externally, everything ticked all the boxes. So I was successful, like you say. I was a tutor. I had a full-time job. I had a house, a car, dog, partner. So everything looked externally, you know, as if it was perfect. Only I had used alcohol for a period of time. I mean, realistically, I would say when I was studying at 21, I probably could have identified a problem with alcohol then. But when I was 30 in 2005, it really became apparent because from the February of that year, I was unsuccessful in obtaining a permanent position because it was like an hourly paid. And I really took that bad. So really my drinking just lifted, it elevated from something that would be perceived as normal drinking, as in camouflaged with people who drank like me in pubs where people drank excessively. And that's what we say, you know, is you kind of hide the fact that you drink so much by merging yourself with people who do exactly the same. So it's almost as if it became, well, it certainly was normal to me to go and drink in excess of an evening. So yeah, it became apparent that I wasn't dealing well with my emotions when of a rejection. It was utter rejection, you know. And then and the fact that I knew somebody else had been successful in that post, and I then had to retrain them into my position that I was in, and my response was a lot of anger. So, you know, I often say when I got sober in 2005, you know, I was like a ball of anger, you know, and not just about the current situation of the role, but just, you know, a lot of anger of unsaid things or unsaid and undealt with issues from the past, I suppose, came out when I drank. I often say that people would give me bullets and I would fire them. You know, I'm not proud to say that. But what I found was what differentiated me from other people was where people found it was like Dutch courage. For me, it was like ammunition. And it wasn't a positive effect of drink when I was, you know, when I was 30, as to what it was when I was 18. And it was all experimental when I went to university. So there was a definite difference.
And how did drinking impact your life sort of day to day?
I think because I was drinking to excess, and I was one of those people who wouldn't possibly drink in the morning, you know, I had a sense of pride about that. However, it was impacting on my relationships with people. I was quite paranoid about things. I was, like I say, full of anger. I would take things incredibly personable. And my relationships with people suffered the most, especially within the home. So I'm, you know, by choice, I've got no children. So thankfully, no children were affected. However, my mood was variable, should we say. It was unpredictable. And I, you know, we talk about alcohol being a depressant, you know, and yet we reach for it thinking it's going to solve the problems, make us feel better. But actually I was very low, very unhappy. And yet my life externally, was brilliant. I had everything I could ever want. And yet internally I felt as if I'd failed in some way, but I don't know what I failed at. So it's just feeling, you know, despondent a lot of the time. And of course, they say, you know, when you come into recovery, it's like a ripple effect. So just me and my drinking and my behavior, the ripple effect of that was my, you know, negative relationships with people, isolation, where I stopped talking to people about how I truly felt, which was, you know, which is, it also fed into the fact that I needed more drink to ignore those feelings. So yeah, just living a life which was totally detached from reality, I suppose.
Yeah, and I guess also for, you know, many of us turn to alcohol to help, I guess, suppress emotions that don't feel good or to cope with things day to day. And I think also for many women as well, who may on the outside look like they've got this everything together, you know, they've got this successful career, they're juggling loads of stuff, you know, like home life, and have almost got this kind of front on them that, you know, I need to hold it all together. It feels like it can be a bit of a taboo subject to talk about, especially. So what was it for you that was the defining moment that kind of made you stop and think things need to change?
Yeah. Well, for me, like I said, I was, you know, I came into recovery like a ball of anger. And the defining moment was when I drank to blackout, which was where I drank. I mean, this is quite often, I must say, you know, where you get to the point where you don't remember what happened the night before. And a lot of people used to, you know, used to say, oh, it's a good sign of a good night. But the truth of it was, you know, it was becoming common in my drinking, certainly within the last 7 to 8 months of my drinking. And it got to a point where I couldn't remember what I'd done this night. And it was disclosed to me that I had actually threatened somebody in a pub, which, you know, I'm not proud of, but it's something where, you know, it just, the explosion must have just happened. And I had absolutely no control over it whatsoever, to the point where I woke up the next day. I knew something had changed. I knew there was a different feeling in my body, a sense of doom, a sense of dread, a sense of massive shame, and I had to be told what had happened. And thankfully, you know, I didn't actually physically fight this gentleman, but, you know, just knowing that I'd got to a point where I had lost control of it scared me enough, because, you know, I've got close relatives who'd spent a lot of time in prison due to drink related crimes. So it's almost like, you know, we call it now that I'm in recovery, it is a family illness. So you mentioned that one in four people have, you know, have mental health difficulties. But the truth that I was told within the first few months of sobriety was one in four people make it into recovery from alcohol abuse.
Wow.
And for me, I was one of four within my close relatives, and I wanted to be that one who made it.
Yeah. How did you start that process then, that journey to recovery? What were the steps that you took?
The steps that I took were, you know, I like I said, I drank in the same pub. I camouflaged myself with these people, and there was one lady there who had got sober. I used to drink with her, but she'd got sober and her life was amazing. And every time I drank, I would ask her about how she did it. And on the night that, you know, the last night of my drinking, or certainly the episode, I had been speaking to her that day. And, you know, I just phoned her straight away and just said, look, this is out of control. I need to know where you've gone, what you've done. And I literally held on to her shirt tail. And, you know, I went to, for me, my recovery started in AA, which is Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, for me, being a 30-year-old professional woman sitting in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous was totally shameful. Absolutely shameful, because I thought, has it come to this? But the truth was, you know, I left that meeting, that first meeting, knowing that my drinking had got out of control, and my behaviour when I drank was unpredictable. So that was my first step. And they said, you know, that if you don't have a drink, if you don't take the first drink, you can't get drunk. So I just didn't take the first drink for that one day. And then the next day, and then the next day. And this wonderful woman who took me to the first meeting said, you know, the days become weeks, the weeks become months, and the months become years. And, you know, touch wood, she says, looking around for some wood, it's just over 15 years for me now without taking that first drink.
Amazing. And you were saying about you felt, you know, as a professional woman going to that first AA meeting, like you felt quite ashamed. What advice would you give somebody who might be thinking that or feeling that right now, but probably knows maybe logically I should go and do that and reach out for that help? What would you say to them?
I would say, do you know what? It starts with a phone call anyway. You don't have to show up at a meeting. Obviously, at the moment, it's all on phone anyway, or Zoom. But, you know, the truth of it is, it starts with a phone call with somebody who's been there and done that. And I think the first thing for me when I went to that meeting, yes, there was an overwhelming sense of shame. But what I got from being there was other women who had experienced exactly the same thing as myself, you know, who had drank excessively, and really their life had spiraled out of control. And the first thing we say is, like, identify with these people. So for me, there was one particular lady who was totally different. She lived in You know, she lived in a flat, she'd lost the children, she'd lost a marriage. But when she described the sense of loneliness that she felt when she drank, wow, that absolutely blew me away, because I couldn't pinpoint, other than anger, that depth of loneliness that I felt when I was drinking. So what would I say to anybody who's contemplating if they've got a problem with drink, is speak to somebody and find out. You don't have to sign up, it doesn't cost you anything, you know, but actually speak to somebody who has experience of that. And you know, nobody will tell you whether you're an alcoholic, a binge drinker, or whatever label that, you know, that people put. But if you want your life to get better and you want to stop being dependent on alcohol, talk to somebody who's been there and done it.
And are there any other ways or any other people or resources that you turn to that were really helpful for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So not everybody wants a 12-step fellowship, that, you know, nobody wants to go and declare it in a group. So there's a number of things that I mean, I went into treatment at 3.5 months sober. So I went into an alcohol drug abstinence service, and they promoted at that time, you know, complete abstinence, which was great for me because I was already sober anyway. So treatment is always an option where you have, you know, you can get state funded or you can pay for private treatment. That is always an option. There's also, you know, coaches like myself who have experience. I've got a recovery coaching program there available on my website. But there's also a company that I'm going to mention, if that's okay, which is SP Bespoke, which I've been introduced to in the last year. And they are a fantastic company where, you know, I've been fortunate to meet them. So what they do is they not only help the person who is struggling with alcohol, but they help the families as well. And for me, you know, this is a family illness, and I was affected by my the alcoholism within my family, but also my alcoholism has affected so many people as well, you know. And what SP Bespoke do is they actually take care of all of that, and they take care of the employment, they take care of the family, and they take care and get the you know, the addict, you know, or alcoholic, they get them sober, you know. So there's so many ways of doing it that, you know, and it all, every single one of them starts with a phone call.
Amazing. I love that. That's really helpful to know, because sometimes you don't really appreciate. I think you've encapsulated that so well, that this is a family
Yeah,
issue, isn't
absolutely.
it? Yeah, that's
Yeah, you
brilliant.
know, and I want to mention as well Al-Anon, which is the Al-Anon family group, which is for friends and family of alcoholics as well. So that again is another free service as well as AA, where you, if you're suffering with somebody in your family who's got a problem with alcohol, they will support you, and it's a recovery program for you as well, because we tend to think that, you know, it's as long as they get sober, I will be okay. But the truth of it is, when those get sober, you realize how much of an impact it's had on you. So we need to look after those people as well.
Brilliant. So, how's life for you now?
Life's really good. It really is good. I love being sober. I love the ability to be able to help people, to know that no matter what, life will get better. Obviously, I own, you know, my own coaching business, which I absolutely love. It's, you know, I have a lot of group coaching as part of it, as well as one-to-one. But you know, my externally, my life doesn't look much different, apart from the fact that I'm in a different role. I'm still with the same man, you know, 27 years together. I'm still probably have a different car, I've still got dogs, you know, and all that. So everything on the external looks the same, but internally, you know, I am so much better. Over the years, I've accessed everything I can access to get well. So personal development, counseling, bereavement counseling. I lost both my parents in recovery, you know, and just the very fact that going through bereavement and without drinking, you know, is something that I'm really, really proud of, but I couldn't have done it without the support of everybody around me. I've got great friends today. I don't camouflage into anything. You know, I feel as if I belong in this world and I fit, you know, which is something you'll hear quite often. If you ever speak to somebody who has a problem with alcohol, they would say they, you know, they didn't really quite fit. They didn't feel as if they belonged, whereas now I'm usually leading the way positively rather than angrily, you know.
Yeah, I really love that. And of course, the path to becoming sober was probably not an easy one either. And there are other things that come up every day in life.
Yeah.
Like you said, you lost your parents during that process, which,
yeah,
you know, for some of us, that may have been, well, I'll go back to alcohol to help me get through that. What,
yeah,
what really were the things then that you did that meant that you kept on the path to recovery?
Yeah. Well, I lost my mum. I was 6 months sober on the day, and my mum died suddenly. So what I had to do on that day was I had to ask for advice about what to do.
Yeah.
And it was as simple as that, you know, and quite often asking for help when you're a professional woman with, you know, it's kind of like going, right, what do I do? And so I asked, thankfully I was in treatment, so I had counsellors around me, and I literally said, what do I do? And they said, you know, go to Southport, see your mum, and I didn't get there in time, and then come back, because I live in Stockport, so it was an hour drive away. I didn't drive, I couldn't drive, and they said, you know, get to a meeting that night. So I went to a meeting, and I surrounded myself with people who had lost people in recovery, so that I knew that I didn't have to drink, that there was an alternative. And I had a wonderful lady who kept on the phone to me all the way back from Southport to Stockport that day, just talking utter rubbish to me. Didn't matter what she said,
yeah,
she just kept me safe. And then, you know, I knew what to do then when my dad died 5 years later, sorry. I knew what to do. I knew that I had to get to meetings. I knew that I had to speak to people. And all those feelings that I bottled up before when I drank, you know, I had to talk. I do a lot of writing in my recovery. You know, and I encourage anybody to write the feelings out, identify what they are. And then just, you know, just really embrace all the help that's available to you.
Brilliant, brilliant. Thank you for that amazing advice, which just coincides actually with something similar that I've just recorded today, which was about, you know, often as women, or well, most of us don't feel able to reach out to other people and ask for help and advice and support. We just feel often that we ought to have the solution, and we, you know, somebody wants to just man up a bit, you know, and it's woman up a bit. But so that really does, I really relate to that, because I've just literally recorded something on that very topic.
And I think, you know, you don't have to, it doesn't have to be a public display. You can just ask one person for help.
Yeah.
That's it. That's it. And even just voicing it breaks the power of it.
Yeah, I agree. And also, like, you made the point about surrounding yourself with people that you could relate to or that could inspire you to keep going. And that was something through struggles of my own that I made the conscious choice to do, to kind of go and hang out with people, maybe not always people that I totally related to, but maybe people that were doing things in a different way, despite their challenge, to help me find some perspective as well, and what I learned from them. So I'm so pleased that you said that.
Yeah.
Awesome advice. So, okay, let's just finish then. If there's somebody right now that's kind of in the situation that they found that you were in, or something similar, and maybe they're struggling, what's the one piece of advice that you could offer them?
I would say, if you're sat there listening to this and you're questioning your own drinking, then there's probably something to question. So my advice would be, to pick up the phone, whether it's to Alcoholics Anonymous, and talk to somebody about your drinking, or just reach out and say to somebody, I need help with this. I don't know what to do. And then go for the first step, whatever that step may be. And just know that you're worth it. And actually, recovery is amazing. Your life can be amazing.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for that. So, Becky, if people want to find you, they want to connect with you, get in touch with you, where can they find you?
Okay. You can find me on LinkedIn, obviously, Becky Field. And also, if I'm quite active on Facebook, I have loads of Facebook groups for my various group coaching sessions. So, Facebook is Westfield Coaching, and just connect. It'd be lovely to speak to anybody.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. It's been totally awesome to talk to you and hear all your amazing advice.
Oh, thanks, Joe. Thanks ever so much.
You've been listening to the Mojo Matters podcast with Joe Britton. Tune in again for more practical advice on how to find your mojo and how to keep it.